This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now settle in, because I have a story to tell. A story about a boy named Leo. Born in 1908 to working-class immigrants from England, his people came to America following their Mormon faith. And these Latter-day Saints pushed handcarts across the American West in search of better lives. And Leo's life was easier than that of his pioneer parents. He married Anne when they were both 18. Leo drove a Wonder Bread truck and eventually became a sales manager at Chrysler. And even though neither Leo nor Anne attended college, they bought a home and raised five children. All five of their kids did graduate from college. Four earned advanced degrees. None had a dollar of student loan debt. Now, Leo was my maternal grandfather. His fourth child is my mom. And his quintessential 20th century American dream story? Well, it no longer exists. Most American children today will not have higher wages or more wealth than their parents. An American family today, headed by a single earner without a college degree, would have a very hard time owning a home. And it's nearly impossible for a kid from a working class household like my mom to graduate from college without student loan debt. And let's be clear, today's student loan debt ain't your or my grandpa's student loan debt. In the last decade, student loan indebtedness has increased more than 107%, driven by rising college costs, dramatic cuts to state funding for higher ed, and the aggressive entry of private lenders into the student loan market. And student loan debt has ranging consequences on the U.S. economy as a whole. A 2019 Washington Post article noted that student loan debt impacts everything from marriage rates to the housing market to small business formation, which is why nearly 45 million Americans who collectively owe $1.7 trillion in student loan debt cheered on Friday when President Biden extended the pause on monthly payments and interest charges on federal student loans through the end of January 2022. But while Biden extended the repayment pause, he appears unwilling to budge on canceling anything more than $10,000 in student loan debt per borrower. Last month, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said that in order to cancel as much as $50,000 in student loans, Congress, not the president, would need to act. And Speaker Pelosi also appeared to argue that the policy was unfair to people whose children don't plan on going to college.
Suppose your family was not, your child just decided they want to, at this time, not want to go to college, but you're paying taxes to forgive somebody else's obligations, you may not be happy about that. But you know what? We want all of our kids to reach their fulfillment. To the extent that they want to go to college, we do not want them to be prohibited from doing that for financial reasons.
Speaker Pelosi has framed this issue as being about kids reaching their fulfillment, but it might be much bigger than that. Solving the student debt crisis may just be about fulfilling the promise of the American dream. For more, I'm joined now by Michael Arsenault, New York Times bestselling author, and his latest book is a collection of essays titled, I Don't Want to Die Poor. Thanks so much for being here, Michael.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, MHP.
And also with us is Louise Seamster, assistant professor of sociology and African American studies at the University of Iowa. Good to have you here as well.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, Professor Seamster, I want to start. And I started by talking about my maternal grandfather, who was white. And I did that on purpose to sort of point to the like expansive nature of this problem. But your research shows that student debt is also a racial justice issue. Can you explain how?
Sure, absolutely. We got into this just trying to understand what had happened with wealth over the Great Recession. And what the major story that came out of looking at debt over this period was a steep rise in student debt, and especially for Black households. So what we've been finding in our most recent study is that white student debt doubled since 2000, and Black student debt by household has gone up fourfold. So it's already unmanageable for many, many white families, but it's actually a severe crisis for Black families. And at the same time, the number of Black households holding student debt has about doubled over that period as well. So we have more people holding much more debt. And at the same time, their wages have not increased accordingly. And so this has really changed the story of what student debt is. And we can't make the same assumptions that people still make about like what college does for you over your lifetime in terms of better earnings with this burden of student debt following you over a lifetime. And it's also much harder to pay down for Black families for reasons we can get into. But altogether, we are really concerned about what this means for Black wealth as a whole, especially since college is supposed to be the key to economic mobility, especially for Black folks. And it has for decades in the past century. But at this point, we're seeing that Black households with student debt actually have much less wealth than their white counterparts. So we're seeing this actually exacerbating racial inequality as far as student debt goes.
Michael, I feel like somewhere you are raising your hand almost in prayer as you hear this, because I know that what the professor is talking about here is in part your story.
I started kind of walking around like one of the old Price is Right models. I was just like, yeah, this is me. My experience has been, I graduated from Howard University. I mean, I've mentioned throughout the promotion of I Don't Want to Die Poor that the same week I became a New York Times bestselling author, I lost my health insurance because I couldn't handle not only the weight of the financial responsibility of my student loans, I was also grossly underpaid just by being Black and gay because my honor left, unless it all ties together. With Howard, I basically have, up until very recently, been paying well over $1,000 a month in student loans for over a decade, because my loans were private loans, which disproportionately impacts Black college graduates. I kind of liken it to like the same way they do the subprime mortgage crisis. They take advantage of like already inequities and just kind of go there. It just was an overwhelming experience. Having to pay that much money over a month has deprived me of so much. That's why I ended up writing a whole book about it. And the whole thing about I Don't Want to Die Poor, and I'll stop here. But in one of the essays that I wrote for the New York Times, that kind of jumpstarted this whole process where I just kind of finally opened up about the financial weight and how this really impacted every part of my life. I used an anecdote about basically how my family thought I was suicidal, but as I always told my mom, there's no way I would take my own life at this point because you would still be on the hook for my debt. If there's any one thing that I can describe with the kind of internal trauma that can be with that, it'd probably be that sentence.
And exactly that level of trauma, the idea of not only do I have to stay alive, not only do I have to keep working, right? But like that this is debt that could follow my beloved, right, beyond the grave for me. Professor, a recent study by the Pew Charitable Trust says that, you know, borrowers, are saying that if they had to restart their loan payments, say next month, right, if there hadn't been this extension of the pause in payments, would have had trouble doing so. Now, listening to Michael, that is not surprising to me. I mean, I'm paying student loans, but they're like $250 a month. They're nothing like the level of burden that we're talking about for so many student borrowers now. How are they ever going to, I mean, pause or no pause, how are people ever going to get out from under this?
They're increasingly not. And I don't think that all our data that we have necessarily captures what is happening to people. I've decided recently to start trusting the number of people who say, I borrowed this much, I've paid for 10 years, I now owe more than when I started, because it's actually a simple mathematical problem. The interest is set so high that people can't, even with these very burdensome payments every month, that they're not able to even dig themselves out from under the interest. And then,
Professor, I feel like I want you to stop right there and say it again, yeah. Because again, I still think there are some people who don't get it, that people have been paying. And
right.
What?
Yes. Yeah. So, and this, I suspect this is especially true for Black families. So the federal government has looked at the problem of debt burden as a problem of repayment and worrying about students going into default, so not paying at all. And so they have made reforms so that you can get a new payment level set so that you're paying according to your salary. That means accepting that your overall loan amount is going to go up month after month for the most part, if you're paying less than the interest accumulates. You're supposed to, at the end of this, get debt forgiveness already if you're in this income derived payment program. But what we're seeing is this payment period is so long that you have to really trust the government that they're going to, you know, in 20 to 25 years, give you back the remainder. And we're not seeing that happen. And in fact, Persis U has, they FOIA'd the government and found that only 32 people have had their loan forgiven at the other end. And yet, you know, this is kind of a wild situation, because the more I learn, the more I realize we don't know, and that people are kind of just assuming all these programs work without the evidence that at the other end they're working. And so everybody's just saying, oh, well, this isn't a crisis because students can just all get into these income derived repayment programs and get their debt forgiven at the other end. But we're actually not seeing their debt get forgiven at the other end. And so I am really wary of any reforms that don't involve like significantly reducing these debt burdens, because we're not talking about people who are just like waltzing away from their debt and holding it forever. We're talking about people like Michael who are making significant payments month after month, and just the debt increases regardless. And like our federal student interest rate is still around, I think, 6%. I mean, not right now because of the pause, but like that's higher than a lot of consumer debt interest. Mm-hmm. It's certainly less than corporations have to pay for their debt.
Michael, do you experience these loans as predatory?
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, I felt that kind of immediately when I signed up for them. I mean, it's just honestly, you have to make certain choices. I wanted to go to certain types of schools, and I didn't think I could afford that. I didn't actually think I could afford Howard. I kind of explained in the book how that process happened. But ultimately, I wanted to pursue a specific career path. And even if I grew up poor and not with all that access, I had the opportunity to do it. And I don't think... The thing is, like, if people ask me, would you do it all again? And my kind of choice is, I wouldn't be talking to you if I didn't do any of this. Like, I mean, people's paths can shift and there can be different types of success. But like, that was an access point that someone like me otherwise would never been able to have. They preyed upon me in that a lot of these terms I didn't understand and take advantage of. Like, I take responsibility for taking out the loans. I knew I'd be taking on debt. What I didn't realize was that ultimately, even with the private loans, that really did take so much of my life. But the government loans, I'll just say like this, in 12 years, at least 13, I've paid $100,000 off in my private debt. That was actually more so everything I took out altogether. But because of those government loans, they haven't moved. If anything, that debt is tripled. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate within the last year to pay off all but one of my private loans. But in total, ideally by the end of next year or after, I'm just going to cross my fingers and everything else about it. Ultimately, I would have paid about $160,000 at least on what was like a little bit under $100,000 of a loan. Mm-hmm. And that's in like about 15 years. And I'm a writer in this economy. So, I mean, there are a lot of different challenges, but ultimately, like, as the private lenders, just even now, only are people able to get out or even file bankruptcy. That was the thing I don't think a lot of people understand, because of a 2005 bankruptcy bill that actually was in the past, but Senator Biden then worked on. Only now are people even able to sue and successfully be able to discharge their debt. And I noticed when I started raising hands, curiously, most of them are white. So you literally have to be able to afford legal representation to file bankruptcy to get discharged. I wouldn't have been able to do any of that. I just had to deal with it.
So, Louise, let me come to you, because Michael's talking here about multiple different aspects of this system. The private loan system, we haven't quite talked yet about the Parent Plus system, the federal loan system. This question about whether or not this portion of debt can even be discharged in bankruptcy. Can you talk just a little bit about the differences across those various forms?
Sure. I mean, one key thing to understand is that debt can shift over a person's whole life. So, you know, a student like Michael would make a decision or not necessarily understand the decision, because schools sometimes get incentivized to kind of be opaque about how this works. But, you know, a student will take out either federal or private loans or a combination if the federal loans are insufficient to cover it all. But they also have the opportunity when they graduate to try and refinance a public loan into the private market. And there's actually always been this confusing overlap between what's private and what's public. You know, the federal government used to just guarantee private student debt, which made an incentive for lenders because they were getting paid even more if students defaulted. But they also spun off entities like Navient and Sallie Mae, so that they, you know, they had this like weird public-private feel. And so, you know, you can start with a public debt that ends up private. You can not really understand the difference between consolidating your loans within the federal system or refinancing. And then there's the loan servicers, either way, who are getting, you know, paid a cut for managing your loan. In addition to the Parent Plus loans you mentioned, where parents can take out debt on behalf of their students, there's also Anne Helen Peterson has been writing recently about the Grad Plus system, which allows people to take even more debt out. And she's been saying that that represents what we call predatory inclusion as well, especially as the credential expectations rise since the Great Recession, where, you know, wages aren't going up. So if you're going to make enough money to live, especially to repay your loans, you might need to go back to school, which, you know, starts to sound a bit like a, I would say, a predatory system, like, oh, this didn't work for you, come back to school and do it all again and take out more debt.
Look, Michael, as I'm listening to Louise talk about this cycle, and I, you and I have had this conversation before, that I got pissed over the course of the past month because I'd been paying my student loans on time, relatively low, you know, payments for 20 years, had some, you know, tough times during the economic downturn of COVID, and Navient started calling me like I had murdered someone, like calling me day and night, just every moment. And you were the person I turned to because I was like, I know Michael understands these so-called loan servicers.
Yeah, when people, I write about how I've been harassed, how they speak to you, even like around Christmas. People, I mean, generally speaking, people look down on anyone they consider poor or beneath. It's a really ridiculous American attitude given the meaning economy, but I digress. But yes, they will harass you. They will berate you. People make you feel like you are the worst thing alive, and they really have free reign to harass you day and night, particularly if you have private loans. And I remember you did text me about that, and I was just like, I feel your pain. And also just, I went back to my old Catholic ways and did the sign of a cross and like, thank God they don't bother me anymore. I wouldn't wish that on anyone because it is true harassment.
And so, Louise, I'm wondering about that, like these experiences, and Michael saying, you know, people are constantly asking him, would you do it again? So I guess, you know, as a college professor, as someone who does believe in the value of higher ed, but also really worried, right? You're a college professor as well, really worried also about what the cost of a credential, and that language seems important to me, not just an education, but the cost of a credential is college worth it? Should families and young people still be taking out loans right now?
Okay. Yeah. It's complicated because where I tend to put my emphasis instead of like individual choices and a terrible mm-hmm. system of choices is thinking about how to change the system, because this is all completely, you know, human made and could be different. So what we've decided is that higher education has to come at this cost. Like my friend Danielle Purifoy has said, you know, we know that our society doesn't value higher education because they make you pay for it literally for the rest of your life. Like they're punishing you almost for getting an education. And I think that I see that with my students at both University of Tennessee and now Iowa, where I teach. Debt is not something that these students are experiencing once they graduate or leave college. They're experiencing it from the minute they get into college. It shapes all of their decisions. And they just, it's this marathon run at a sprint where they're taking too many classes. They can't focus. They're having severe mental health crises often because they're taking on too much. And when I tell them to stop, you know, to take a regular amount of classes, they say, I can't, because I need to try and graduate on time or graduate early. I cannot take on more debt. I've been cut off by my family. You know, there's a million stories, and they're working, you know, almost full time. They transferred from community college. So when people are imagining like what the college experience is like, you know, and they're thinking about Animal House, it does, you know, I'm sure there's still people doing that, but they're the people who didn't have to take on debt, I think. And so we've got this like dual track system where everybody else is just racing the clock to, you know, try and make it out. And that's not, so I think all this is completely fixable if we just restructured how higher education is paid for and made this public institution actually free to attend, as we do with K-12 public schools. Like, And so I think that I don't like to say what a family should do, because this is a really hard situation. And it's not like, oh, you should have simply made the better choice. Like, this is a national problem and not a problem of the people who made bad choices versus the ones who made good choices.
Louise Seamster is an assistant professor of sociology and African-American studies at the University of Iowa. And Michael Arsenault is the author of I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I Put My Faith in Beyonce, and his most recent book, I Don't Want to Die Poor. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.